Oh yeah, of course he is. He did it last year.
Did he?
Yeah.
Oh, the dock scene. Yeah.
Hi there. If you were expecting to see me led away in chains today, I'm afraid the entertainment may not be quite that good. You'll notice that it says on my slide that this talk is, my personal opinion, not HP approved. Here, for the HP approved part of my talk, is Mr. Martin Fink, General Manager of the Linux Systems Division of Hewlett Packard.
Can you hear me? So probably a number of you saw earlier in the press that Bruce was intending to do some interesting and deliberate illegal acts with the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, which he will go through and describe. So I thought it might be useful to give you a little bit of history of Bruce and I working together at HP and the corporate structure that I gave Bruce to please not do that. And he has agreed to actually not do that. The primary reason is because I have a thing about my employees being thrown in jail. And so we're going to try and keep Bruce out of jail, and hopefully he'll thank me one day for that. A little less than two years ago, I hired Bruce, and as Bruce says, I am responsible for Linux and open source at HP. And when I hired Bruce, HP wanted to do the best job that it could to interact and work with the open source community. And I felt that the best way to do that at the time was to have an expert in the open source community to make sure that as we were getting engaged, we were doing it properly. And so Bruce and I were talking about the option of him coming to work for HP. Obviously, one of his major concerns was, hey, I can't be the corporate shill here. I can't stand up all the time and just be the HP mouthpiece, you know, pre-programmed. They have need for that. So that's my job. And so we did a special, and we gave Bruce a special sort of dual-padded role, in that he plays two roles, and his number one role is to be a leader in the open source community. And his second job, or job two, is to be an HP employee. And he and I have talked through a number of rules that he follows in terms of how he plays that role, and making sure that we sort of walk this fine line of being an employee one day and not being the employee the next. And for, as Bruce mentions in his talk today, he is not acting as HP employee. Now, the thing that has happened over the past couple of years is it looks like Bruce and I have reversed dress codes, and so now I can dress up and he wears the tie. So the other thing I want to talk about specifically was the Digital Millennium Copyright Act and give you the official or formal HP perspective on it. Because it is a very complex issue. We do understand that there are the aspects of the Digital Millennium Copyright Act which are not favorable to the open source community, that are not favorable to the openness or free speech aspects that Bruce will talk about. On the other side of that coin, and even when Bruce and I have talked about this, there is pretty wide agreement that those who generate media or generate content, whether that content is distributed through media like DVDs or through the airwaves, that the content producers have a right to get paid for their content. And so the interesting thing is that I think there's wide recognition on both sides of this issue that the content providers deserve to get paid for their content, and it, you know, it doesn't take a rocket scientist to figure out that at some point, if they're not getting paid, the content will stop getting produced. And so the entertainment industry, the media generation industry, is I guess living on their legacy of trying to control the access to their content and distribution, etc., in order to ensure that they get paid and eliminate as much of the piracy as possible. And in the process of incorporating those, I think what Bruce will refer to as constraint systems, and in Bruce not doing an illegal act today, I acted as a constraint system on Bruce. these constraint systems sort of collide and clash with open source and with some of the opinions of those with free speech. And so there is no easy answer to this, right? So I was actually talking to the press earlier this morning and saying, so what's the answer? And there is no answer today. And so that's the hard part. Now, both sides here of this issue tend to try and vilify the other side. So on the advocates of free speech and open source will try to vilify the content producers by saying they're trying to grab too much control over that freedom. And the content producers will try and vilify the open or free speech provider, those who are trying to do piracy of their content and prevent them from getting paid. And so that's really what we have to break through here. And I know at the end of this presentation, Bruce, I think, has a slide on, you know, what can you do? And the one thing, and I was actually just reviewing a slide deck before I stood up here, that I didn't see on that slide was, I think we now have to look for new technology options. And I don't know what the answer is, but I would like to see us move beyond the world of vilifying both sides of this issue and get to a point where we sit down on both sides and say, what are the goals on both and what are the technology options that are available to us so that the open source community, the leaders of free speech, etc., can have their rights in owning their content and not having it expire on them or not being able to play it because, as Bruce will show you, buying a DVD in Europe and playing it in the U.S. is problematic these days, and you can kind of overcome that, but at the same time, we do have to make sure that the media and content generators get paid for their content. And so what can you do? I mean, most of everybody in this room is a set of pretty bright technologists, and so I'll ask everybody in this room to basically take on the cause of the challenge of looking for those solutions. And I suspect that this is going to be contentious for some time to come, but let's look for what that technology solution is so that both sides can win out of this. And that is.
Have you seen that at least that Hollywood would at least accept that? Because it seems that they have an all or nothing. They will crush us if they, I mean, that's what they've chosen to do.
So I think we have a lot of Hollywood customers, right? HP works with, for example, DreamWorks and Disney and some of the Hollywood producers. And we have some of those contacts with the community. And part of the role that folks like Bruce can play working for HP is to try and use, and what I'd like to see HP used as, is the bridge back to Hollywood. And so if we have solutions and you're saying, look, I just need to get Hollywood at the table, I'll take that one on. Right, I'll personally take that one. So if the issue is we can't get the right folks at the table, then I think there are ways we can fix that. Okay.
How can there be a technology solution to giving up the rights that we've had in this country for years? I don't see how we can develop a technology solution.
I think I want to get into my talk actually.
Okay, so.
Thank you very much. Martin is dealing with the remainder of the issues around the HP merger. And I remember there was a cover on The Economist a couple of years ago of two camels making love, and they were trying to make a metaphor for mergers. And, you know, it's worth doing, but extremely awkward in the process. And Martin actually took from his time working on that to fly out from Houston, where there is no direct flight to San Diego, just to, first of all, I guess save me from myself. Not that I think I would really have been arrested, but also prevent me from dragging HP into the volcano along with me. Now, obviously, I could still do it, but that would damage HP's Linux program, which would probably be a bad idea, especially since they've been our friend in many good ways. For example, they've done very much for Debian and sponsored Debian with Debian 64, among other things. So anyway, we get into the talk, and hopefully I'll be able to address some of the questions that you have for Martin. Thank you, Martin. So I'm going to introduce a word that you might already know, might not. What is a constraint system? My favorite example is a chastity belt. Okay. Chastity belts were actually functional. They had a little grill so that you could perform certain activities that would otherwise be obstructed by the belt. And they prevented you from doing some things. And that is essentially what a constraint system is. It is a hall monitor, possibly in this case a hall monitor in your own home, that prevents you from taking certain activities. Copy protection is the most common example, and the problem that we have for the most part with copy protection is that it protects us from doing more than just copying, and we also have some legitimate kinds of copying. DVD fast forward lockout. This is the one I think annoys the most people, where there are DVDs with commercials or promos for upcoming movies, and you go to press fast forward. And on my player, it actually has this little hand icon, like it's a traffic cop. And it says, you can't do that. Well, what the hell? I paid for the disc. I paid for my player. No, you can't do that because you'd be violating someone else's right. You put this commercial in, and, you know, has an expectation of revenue. Okay, so that one is just one of these things where if you modify your player to defeat it, you'd be let in for this $500,000 fine that I'm apparently not getting today. Ebooks that expire. People go to medical schools where they get ebook textbooks, which are not saleable at the used bookstore when they're finished with the course. And of course, the professor who wrote it, you know, he's your professor at the school, wants his full revenue from the next semester students. So we have a constraint system that enforces that. ECPA, Electronic Communications and Privacy Act, 1984. This is when it all started. The ECPA locked out certain frequencies on your radio. You could not buy a radio that received analog cell phone calls. We're not considering that if you have any of those old TVs with the analog UHF dials, well, we recycled those channels to be cell phones. So you can actually receive the analog calls on those TVs. They just don't want you buying a new scanner that receives them. So in my mind, that was when the Iron Curtain started to drop, was the fact that you could not listen to certain channels on the radio, and it was your responsibility and not the responsibility of the person doing the transmitting to keep that channel secure. After all radio is broadcasting. Okay, zone code. I have some DVDs here, which I bought in London, and I have to admit I was posing as a normal person because I knew that these DVDs would not work when I took them home to my US player, but a lot of people would not know that. You know, so there I went to Great Britain, took advantage of their wanting me to be a tourist and buy in their stores. And when I come back home, I find that the things that I've bought will not work. And it happened that my video player was a PAL system player, besides NTSC. So I could play their video system, but there was just a constraint system that said, nuh-uh, these movies are meant for the British market. You cannot play them in the U.S. player. Upcoming laws, HDTV, the Broadcast Protection Field. Okay, this is something that they said in the HDTV transmission. It says, you may not record or you may not perform various other activities. Now, there are a couple ways this could be implemented. It could be implemented so that the equipment just passes this bit on for your recorder to honor or not. Or it could be that your TV actually authenticates your video tape recorder as one that responds with the correct correct password, and that video tape recorders who have not been given the correct public key encryption for zero knowledge proof that they're legitimate will certainly not be sent to signal by your TV. Okay, so there are a couple ways of doing that, and obviously, as people who want to place a handle television in free software, we would like to have this protection field be something that is passed along for us to honor or perhaps not honor if we have legitimate reasons to not honor it. And then there are the really crazy ones. I think her name was Nancy Pelosi, proposed in California that cars have a little remote control receiver and that police just be able to push a button and stop your car rather than having a hot pursuit. And she had a very good reason. Her husband, who was a surgeon, in fact, an emergency surgeon, had been killed when a vehicle in a hot pursuit who was not involved in hit him. And then in Stanford, there's a proposed device that prevents you from buying things on the gray market. In other words, buying a Japanese version of your camera and then using it in the United States and getting it cheaper that way. They would build a GPS into the camera and it wouldn't be okay. Somebody at Stanford actually proposed this. So, I mean, it gets crazier and crazier. But the scary thing is that much of this is being implemented. So what is ubiquitous law enforcement? It's like 1984, and there was just a paper on why Orwell was wrong. But it may be that Orwell was indeed right, we just haven't given him enough time. So ubiquitous law enforcement is present everywhere you go, there 24/7, and it's in your house. Okay, and I used to say, because I've done this slide before, is this an insane paranoid fantasy? But we have this DRM, we have Palladium coming, which is a little scary. We have trustworthy computing. You have to wonder which side is being trusted. Traffic cameras and computer facial recognition, which has backfired in very many ways. And my background in this, I worked in the film industry. I have a credit on Toy Story 2 and A Bug's Life. I took the money I got from the Pixar IPO and I bought a very nice home. Thank goodness I didn't put it in the stock market. But, I appreciate that people who work on films have to make their money. And in fact, if I did not make my money on the film, I would not have been able to get HP to give me this totally ridiculous agreement to speak for myself. You know, because the point there is that if they have to fire me, well, I don't care very much. So other things, I've worked on ARPA grants from the U.S. Army on imaging, and I've developed a number of free software programs. So I am on both sides of this issue. I'm not going to bore you with what is copyright, because we don't have as much time as I planned. So here's DMCA, intended to enforce copyright in the digital age, restricts circumvention of digital rights management devices.
Okay. No exception for fair use. Okay. What's a fair use? This is a laptop which has a docking adapter. The docking adapter has a DVD drive. When I go on the airplane, I don't want to take the docking adapter. I want to copy the movie to the hard disk and play it from the hard disk. That is fair use copying. It is entirely for my own use. Okay. If I do that, I get that big, big fine, etc. Even little Stanley doesn't have a father for some years. Okay, no provision for copyright expiration. Things that are protected by digital rights management are protected forever. No quid pro quo. Works never go into public domain. Not that they're letting them go anyway, but that was part of the original quid pro quo of copyright. And then there are a number of cases in which DMCA has effectively prevailed, even when they haven't won in court. For instance, Felton, he was restrained from doing his talk when he went to RIAA had dropped the case, and he was said, no, they dropped it. You can't countersue them. Internet provider liability. Your internet provider is going to catch a lot of the heck for what's happening here, especially with the Berman Computer Vigilante Law. Go read this bill. It was just put up yesterday or the day before, I think. And it says if you are a movie or a music company, and someone is passing around your movie or music, you have a reasonable suspicion that they are. You can go hack into their system, and you don't get prosecuted for it. So this is why I call it the vigilante law. There's no due process. You don't have to prove that they're doing it to any court. You can act first. Okay, now the bill says you can't hurt anything else, and you can't do more than a certain amount of damage, etc. So it intends to limit the effect. You can't kill any files except the one illegal one you're going after. And you have to notify this Department of Justice, but they don't have to tell the guy you're going after unless they ask you, and thus they have to figure out who's attacking them first. So the bill is very hard for me not to vilify. And in the United States, we don't really have the vigilante process for other things. We take people to court, we convict them, they do their time or they pay, etc. So it happens that it's been rather popular, especially since 9/11, to have laws that unleash the federal government on people before they're convicted, if they're ever convicted. So this stuff is bad, and you need to work against it. You cannot just wait for me to do this stuff. Okay, so DMCA implementations. Play control is what is actually copy control. Macrovision, something very interesting. It's on the analog output, and it's meant to mess up your video tape recorder. Disabling Macrovision is also illegal under DMCA. And we have the audio CD Macrovision, which is essentially introducing data errors and making the drive not want to play if it's a data drive. And of course, we have this way that people have found that you take the track with the data errors and you write a black line on it with a magic marker. Okay, now I will not, because Martin has asked me not to, sell you any magic markers during this talk. Okay. Okay, and then we have trusted client devices. I had written Wave Systems on this a while ago, but now Palladium is the real threat. So Palladium is going to make us secure. Palladium is one of the family of things that are called trustworthy computing or trusted systems. Now, these are not all bad. Say you're running a business, and you would like your servers to run only executables which you have cryptographically signed, someone in your IS department has the key to do this, and which passed the checksum on that signature, etc. Hey, that's not a bad idea. And it's not a bad idea because you're the one with the secret key. Okay. The proposal here is not to give you the secret key, at least not for a certain number of things. Trustworthy computing, in part, is built on the assumption that the computer user is the one who can't be trusted, the guy who owns the computer. Thus, your own computer must prevent you from doing harm. So what they do is they put a chip on your motherboard, and that chip has a secret key inside it. And it takes content with a public key, and it decrypts it for you, but it will only pass that information onto programs that are cryptographically signed by someone that the content owner trusts. And in fact, the default deployment of the trusted system is that it will only execute software and boot operating systems that someone other than you trusts. Okay? Linux, GNU, everything else, out the window. Okay, so the Palladium guys realize this is a pretty significant objection. So they've come up with a solution. And the solution is you can turn off the chip. What's the other side of that? If you turn off the chip, you can no longer communicate with people who have the chip turned on because they are sending you encrypted Word files which expire after a certain time. Microsoft has already promised this one. Encrypted web pages, which are mediated by the trusted system, because the content owner wants a payment if you print or save the page. Okay, you can view it, but if you print or save, your Palladium chip will be in the act and will say, well, we have to go through something to return value to the content provider. You know, some of this isn't so bad, except for the fact that it just takes people who actually make their own software and totally locks them out. And I liked, there was an announcement in a Microsoft talk the other day, which was sort of just thrown out and no one noticed very much. They said, the era of open computing and free exchange of information is ending. And they didn't say if they were driving this end or if they just noticed it. But obviously, I don't think they're really on the side of free information exchange. And you know, Martin asked that we not vilify people. I'm actually finding it extremely difficult to not vilify a convicted monopolist. Okay. I guess the administration finds it a little easier these days. So, okay, so again, you can turn the chip off, but you're an island. After that, you can only get open content. People who don't know better will be sending you encrypted content because that will be the default. Okay, so what happens to OpenOffice? You know, OpenOffice won't be compatible with your Word files that are encrypted, etc. Also, there will be a cost attached to encrypting material for public presentation because you will have to take it to someone who certifies that this is not a bootleg before you put it up and puts their digital signature upon it. And that closes what they call the analog hole. Okay? If you could just encode stuff and put it up for play with these systems, well, maybe you can take the video output of your TV and you would record it free and clear. They don't want you to do that. So my contention is that over the long term, just plain people will not be allowed to encode content for public presentation without going through someone else. And the problem is that when that happens, free speech goes right out the window. Okay. So, regulation of information. You know, FCC broadcast television market rules are kind of eroding, but they fight monopoly.
And we have these internet devices that are radios and televisions now that receive programming over the internet. And there's a very interesting economic model for these. You buy the device, and the device only receives from the content provider's portal. So the device can be made very inexpensive because it is a razor, and the content provider is selling you the blades. And you can't switch it to any other portal. Thus, the content provider mediates everything that you watch on that TV or listen to on that internet radio without these fairness rules that the FCC has presented. Now, there are two devices like this. HP actually made one called the Digital Entertainment Center, and it would only download material from the HP portal, and I think they expected about 2,000 sales the first year. It was very obviously a building, a market kind of thing. I think they actually moved 250. Okay. So, which proves that there actually is some intelligence in consumers. I'm sorry, HP. Please, people, do not buy radios that receive only one station. And the problem is that TiVo and Replay, etc., are also following this model now. Okay. There is content that they get from their portal and nowhere else. And years ago, we had a law that said that the automaker could not compel you to buy the automaker's radio, and that they had a standard opening, etc. And I think that's what we need for digital media. This is a content provider should not be the provider of the playback instrument. So what we're looking at, because of all these constraints upon information, is the rollback of the democratization of the internet. People will not be able to post their own content the way they have in the past if this comes to pass the way that I think the big content providers would like it to come to pass. The old media divide, the fact that you needed money to get on television, becomes a new digital divide. The disenfranchised, again, won't be heard. Present media opinion control, the fact that the way they report controls your vote becomes more pervasive. And the way they do that is if you control the presentation, you control what facts are presented, and that means you control people's points of view that they derive from those facts. So you control the votes, and that's how you control the world. It sounds a little paranoid, but it's actually what's happening, I think. So there are unpleasant socio-political implications. Supply-side thinking dominates politics today. DMCA is ridiculously supply-side law. So is the Berman law. Okay. It's a result of economic factors. Hey, people aren't eating. People aren't working. Let's do something good for business. The problem is it tends to devalue the customer, the citizen, the individual. And this is not the only place it's happening. Consider companies like FedEx, for example. I think FedEx has 10,000 people on its IS staff. FedEx is a computer customer. Who is representing FedEx on the World Wide Web Patent Policy Board, which I serve on? Absolutely no one. Okay? Maybe Microsoft is representing them as the vendor who sells to them, but that's not necessarily FedEx's interest. Okay, so we have a very supply-side environment, and part of what we need to do to correct this is mobilize the customer, who the money actually comes from. Okay, Microsoft doesn't make all that money. You send it to them. Okay. And in the case of a Federal Express or a UPS or a Bank of America, these are people who have enough money to really influence things. And I'm sorry, guys, what is happening right now is not in your best interests, because your computer software choice will become limited and your costs will thus go up. So that is the message that I'm bringing to a lot of corporations today. Okay, so what happens if we don't fix this? Supply-side law eventually will cause its own adjustment. We really, really want that adjustment to be peaceful. Thus, it just must happen via the political process. We are not the Taliban. We try to do these things not through force. Procrastination tends to entrench the problem, though. So the best time to pursue political action is now. Hey, guys, we have an election coming up. What is it, the second Tuesday, the first Tuesday in November? Have you guys done anything to muster a vote in any particular direction? Okay, you can't wait for Bruce to do it. We need everybody to work on this. Or, you know, if you have a kid, when your kid grows up, they'll ask you, what was it like when there was free speech?
And you won't be able to tell them.
That's right. By the way, this talk is copyrighted. Please forget it immediately. So what can you do? First of all, technology policy affects all of us, but technical people do not participate. You guys have proven reasonably good at opposing things, especially like when they come up on Slashdot. Sometimes that's enough to motivate people to go and work on them. We don't really have a positive platform yet, you know, and so I'm afraid I get elected to work on that. I'd love to hear from other people too. Don't watch technology policy happen. Show of hands, who knows both who their congressman and who their senator is in the United States? Okay. Who's not from the United States? There were a lot of people who didn't raise either time. Okay, you need to be pen pals. Do not email them. I don't care what anyone else says about their reading their email. Do not email them. And when you get to Washington, you know, you're flying to Europe or something, stop in Washington. Ask if you can visit these people. You know, set it up. Talk about what's concerning you. They need to hear from someone else than Bruce because they're not too sure about Bruce. They need to hear from their own constituents. Okay. One of the worst things that's happening here is once the law is dictating technology policy, you don't get the choice of voting with your wallet or your finger. There is no opt-out. There is no free country to go to anymore. You have to make the one that you're in a free country. Please donate to EFF. They have this a lot more together than I do so far. I got a very concerned email from Robin Gross this morning about, should we talk about this before you do it? But I sent her back that HPN already prevailed. Become more knowledgeable. This is very easy to read up on. Google is a very good source for almost anything. Okay, are you guys registered to vote? Are you voting in the election? Do you have any idea which side is better? Remember, the Democrats gave us DMCA. Politics is about as important as your own heartbeat, and too many of you are just letting it go by. Talk to the people around you about this. You know, there are articles that are easy to understand about what's happening. Certainly some of the ones that have been written about me in the last couple of days. Talk with other people about it. And then the price of freedom is eternal vigilance. And I'm afraid our one problem is that we are just too lazy about this. We concentrate on the project we're working on and what we're hacking. We try to shut out the rest of the world. After all, the rest of the world is so screwed up. That won't do. We need to be part of the political mechanism. I think I have about 1 minute. Am I supposed to end it at 3:15? I think about half. Well, let's see if the other speaker comes in and stops us. I'll take questions.
We have a break after this.
Oh, we have a break after this. Okay, that's good. In that case, I can just take questions for a while. You guys simply won't get to eat. But feel free to leave if you want to eat. Back there, please.
I have been told by my congressman that mail going to Washington is still being delayed in post offices because of the anthrax.
Okay,
facts.
So.
Just facts. They want facts.
Facts.
Finally.
Facts. That's an interesting point. You know, I asked for Barbara Boxer's fax number, and they gave me one in California. And I knew that Barbara Boxer was in D.C. at the time, and I wanted to make an appointment with her. And I ended up having to use HP's lobbyist to call Barbara Boxer's legislative analyst so that I could have an appointment with my own damn senator. And so they are often rather difficult to get through to. But that's a good point. Facts. Go on.
Well, I was just going to say, a tip a friend of mine gave me in Washington is to call up and just ask for the scheduler. And then they go, oh, if you're somebody, you can FaceTime.
You know, the funny, call up and ask for the scheduler, and the scheduler does the members' scheduling, member of Congress or the Senate. Yeah. So sound like you know what you're doing.
Getting ready to maybe know what I'm doing.
You know, the funny thing was, when I called people just to get to see them the last time I was lobbying, and you know, I make business trips for HP, and I stop in Washington on my way to Europe, etc. I go there when I'm going to New York. Hollings staffers were the actual easiest ones to get to. Boucher was actually the only member of Congress that I saw last time, and it was because he wanted publicity on this bill of his that actually weakens DMCA in some ways. Boucher's an interesting character. He actually voted for DMCA and then realized that it did harm. And you know, admitted that he made the wrong decision. I wish they were all like that. Brad?
I just want to mention digitalspeech.org is sponsored by the FSF, but we run it externally. It doesn't necessarily share all of our politics exactly. We're working primarily on grassroots organizing, particularly on college campuses. If you want to get involved and volunteer and help or donate or anything like that, please check out.
This is Bradley Kuhn of the Free Software Foundation. Back there.
So your talk was really interesting, and it strikes me that the group that's perhaps our best ally are the big customers on the other side of the equation. I don't know who they are, whether they're the big banks or the pharmaceutical firms or whoever, who will suffer tremendous lock-in. And if rather than sort of, they seem to be the people who, if we can persuade that it's in their interest to stop this, that will be our biggest point of difference.
Okay, so the point there is that the enterprise customer who wants to pay less for software and get more done and have control is potentially our friend in this. We haven't mobilized them at all. Not a bit. We don't have an organization that puts those guys together to voice their interest in open source and take it to Washington. So that's a short-term project for me. Okay, and that may actually eventually take me outside of HP because I can't be part of the industry and represent the customer at the same time. This is going to be an interesting evolution. The other person is the common people. You know, these guys do vote in the election, and they are the ones affected. And something that we nerds or geeks or whatever have a hard time with sometimes is getting to their level and communicating with them. And in fact, sometimes we call them nasty names like mundanes. And that is not going to help us get them to understand our causes and help us. And, you know, again, hackers, the worst thing for most hackers is writing a user interface for a normal person. We have to get out of that role. We need the rest of the world and to be a part of it if we are going to be able to continue our art. Is there anyone over there? I think I've been taking too many from this side. Okay, go ahead.
I'm pretty happy with my computer today, and I kind of expect the CPU power that I have. A lot of
I mean, that I can use it for the next 5, 10 years. So what is the implication in terms of, let's say some of these things pass? Are people going to come and say, you can't use that old computer anymore?
Okay, so one thing that Microsoft's been very good at, someone commented to me today, is that they keep backwards compatibility. And one of the really bad things I think about Palladium is that Palladium, if used the way I feel it will be used, eventually just takes backwards compatibility and rams it in the toilet. And the question is, have 95% of the market already re-upgraded their motherboard? Did they already have the Palladium chip on it on the flag day when all of this stuff gets turned on? Or not. I must admit, I have started hoarding hard drives. I really have. I buy those 120 megabytes and I just put them away. Martin, did you want to say something? No, I think he'll take the question. I didn't get myself fired here. You know, I care more about this than I care about getting myself fired, but. Was that getting myself fired today would have damaged HP's Linux program, which is exactly what I don't want to do. So I do appreciate that Martin, rather than taking the easy way out, actually flew out here to do this. Going over there. Okay, so what are the analogous things? Well, remember that a lot of the constraint system is driven by intellectual property. So we have a strengthening of intellectual property laws in other countries. For example, the EC directorate has said that they want software patenting to a greater extent than they have today. The countries in the EC have yet to vote for it. Okay, so the stage is being set. There are DMCA-like laws being enacted in other countries. The EC is currently starting to consider it. And there's also a sort of double dipping in that not only are they doing the DRM, but they're also putting a tax on top of the media. So you're not allowed to do infringing things with the media, but you pay a tax for the infringing things that actually go on. And one of the reasons that the technology industry companies like HP will not always be on our side on this reliably is a case that happened in Germany, where HP sold lots of CD writers and some DVD writers, and then retroactively had to pay a tax on them. That essentially got paid to Bertelsmann, which is a big media producer in Germany.
Actually, they're a big media producer in the U.S. too.
Everywhere. And if instead there had been a DRM, well, HP could have said, well, there's DRM and these infringements aren't happening, and thus we don't have to pay the tax. So it is sometimes to their advantage cooperate with the DRM, lest they have to pay for the infringement. So, you know, while I'm just overjoyed with all of the nice things for free software, open source, etc., that I've gotten out of HP, I have to understand that they're a public stock company and that their interests won't always be aligned with mine. But that's what politics is about. It's a lot of diverse interests coming together. Over there. Did anyone from MPAA show up? If so, they didn't tell me. Neither did the guys from FBI. over there.
Yeah, I was going to make a comment about intellectual property. You talk about intellectual property as if it's owned by the creator and then in theory eventually falls into public domain. Maybe we need to think about intellectual property a bit different as it is public property. That's what publishing is, to make public. But we grant a lease back to the creator as an incentive for them to create it. So we should think of it as being leased from the public to the creator.
Okay, Richard Stallman would actually be upset with me for using the term intellectual property, because intellectual property is actually a number of very different things. Copyright is not like patents, are not like trademarks. And just by calling them intellectual property, it very much oversimplifies what is going on. And yes, we are talking about intellectual property as if, yeah, it's something that the generator owns and the public simply doesn't have an interest. Well, it happens that the body politic is where the rights are granted from, and sometimes the body politic extracts a return for those rights. And the original quid pro quo in the copyright was that things did reach the public domain, and don't anymore. So you have a very valid point. Yes?
Can you comment on the law on the political system and the laws that they've been in place? Is there anything we can do in the judicial path to try for DMCA as well?
According to the guy back there. I have a problem with fighting things in the judicial system rather than through the legislature. And the problem is that it is extremely expensive to prove a case. It happens that there are, patents is the very worst thing here. There are a tremendous number of bad patents out there. There are patents on things that are trivial, and there are patents on things that have prior art and they're not inventions. Great, we have our documentation of prior art. Now we just have to go to court and spend $1 million. Okay, so this is not our way of winning the battle, because we're placing ourselves in a battle where the party with the most money wins. Now that is often true with lobbying as well. After all, Berman has $185,000 from the movie companies. He's got to be at least nice to them on the face of it. That's more money than he got from anyone's by far. I think his biggest contributors after that were like $30,000 for this campaign. He took in about $800,000 that we see for this campaign. But the fact is, we're the voters. We're the people who really count in the end. We're not very well organized yet. Okay. So that is how I feel we should be fighting it. My biggest friend in this is publicity. Despite the fact that I'm sort of doing the chicken dance today, we did get a lot of good articles on DMCA, and that will affect a lot of people and possibly influence how they vote and what they talk to their congresspeople about. Just to be nice to the show management here, I am now going to take this out in the lobby where you can corner me and ask me individual questions. Thank you very much.